Rockers in Recovery Media is dedicated to carrying the message of addiction recovery through music, news, events, and festivals taking place within and not limited to the clean and sober community. Rockers in Recovery Radio is based on opinion only and is not meant to treat or diagnose any health or mental health issue of any kind. If you feel you need help for any health-related issues, please contact a physician or mental health professional. The opinions expressed by our guests are not necessarily those of Rockers in Recovery.
Hey, welcome to Radical Recovery with your host, Jack Kelly. Jack, take it away.
This is Jack Kelly, and welcome to Radical Recovery. In 2012, my book, Radical Recovery, 12 Recovery Myths, The Addiction Survivor's Guide to the 12 Steps, was published by Balboa Press. Around July of this year, they will publish my second book, Resilient Recovery, How to Conquer Your Addiction. If you think about it, as alcoholics and drug addicts, we really only have two options. We conquer our addiction, or it conquers us. There is no other option. The cover of my first book had an image of the phoenix rising from the ashes. And if you're not familiar with the phoenix, it comes from Egyptian mythology. The phoenix is an immortal bird, and when it dies, it bursts into flames and is reborn from its own ashes. To rise from the ashes of addiction means to make a miraculous comeback. And if you believe that you are ready to rise from the ashes of addiction and make a miraculous comeback, then welcome to the show. People ask me why I use the word radical. The word radical can bring to mind images of extreme anarchy and violent revolution, but according to Webster's Dictionary, the word radical has a much softer connotation. It is defined as getting to the root or origin of something, thoroughgoing as regards a change from accepted or traditional forms. When chemotherapy was first introduced as a method of treating cancer, it was considered a very radical way of getting to the root of disease because the chemo part of the therapy is a poison, but the poison works, cancer cells. Unfortunately, it also kills healthy cells, which results in very unpleasant side effects. The person infected with the poison most often experiences hair loss, nausea, vomiting, etc. The good news here is that in many cases, the temporary pain and discomfort that comes with the treatment puts the disease into full remission. The odds of staying in full remission increase if the cancer survivor does certain other things, such as eating healthy foods, exercising, taking prescribed medications, vitamin supplements, and of course, no smoking. The bad news for us alcoholics and drug addicts is that the odds of becoming a cancer survivor are much greater than the odds of becoming an addiction survivor. Why? Because we really don't believe that the disease of chemical dependency is a terminal disease, even though millions of addicts and alcoholics have proven this to us over the years again and again. Some of the more prominent ones include Whitney Houston, Amy Winehouse, Elvis Presley, Michael Jackson, Kurt Cobain, Heath Ledger, Anna Nicole Smith, Andy Gibb, Jimi Hendrix, Janis Joplin, John Belushi, and Marilyn Monroe. The belief that is so often reinforced at meetings that I've heard is don't rush into the steps. Once when I was attending a meeting on step four, made a fearless moral and searching moral inventory of ourselves. The man who had not had a drink in 8 years said, "It took me 5 years to complete step four. You didn't get sick overnight. You're not going to get well overnight. Easy does it." Bad advice. He may not have had a drink in 8 years, but he didn't have anything that I wanted. Imagine being diagnosed with cancer and attending your first meeting of Cancer Survivors Anonymous. You let everyone know that you are a newcomer. Can you imagine anyone in that room telling you, don't rush into getting treatment. Your cancer didn't happen overnight. It's not going to disappear overnight. So easy does it. If we really believed that we had a terminal disease, we would approach treatment with the same desire, fervor, and passion that someone diagnosed with cancer seeks treatment, the same desire, fervor, and passion that someone who is drowning reaches for a life preserver. But we don't. Why not? The answer should be obvious. Brain damage. And that's why we have step two. Came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. As alcohol and drugs kill more of our brain cells, here's what happens. We look, but we no longer see. We hear, but we no longer listen. We touch, but we no longer feel. We read, but we no longer comprehend. Another reason we don't believe we have a terminal disease, which may have something to do with the brain damage, is that we don't believe that rules and odds apply to us. If you're like me, you like to make up your own rules and odds. Ah, who cares about odds? But think of this example. In addition to not really believing that addiction left untreated is a terminal disease, we really don't believe that cigarette smoking causes some dreadful diseases, such as lung cancer, emphysema disease, respiratory problems, etc. If we really believed that cancer was a terrible disease, we would stop smoking. But about 90% of the people who seek treatment for alcohol or drugs are also addicted to nicotine, and I certainly sympathize. I smoked 2 packs of cigarettes a day for many years. So the disease of chemical dependency, whether it's an addiction to pills, alcohol, drugs, or nicotine, is cunning, baffling, and powerful. And that's one reason why the relapse rate is so high. But it wasn't always this way. Let's go back and take a look at the history of our fellowship. According to the original members of AA, they tell us, if our experience is any criterion, more than half of those approached will become members of Alcoholics Anonymous. Alcoholics Anonymous came into existence in 1935. The second edition to the book was published in 1955. The recovery rate over that 20-year period followed a similar pattern. They tell us, of alcoholics who came to AA and really tried, 50% got sober at once and remained that way. 25% sobered up after some relapses, and among the remainder, stayed on with AA, showed improvement. Now, according to the U.S. Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, 80% of the drug addicts and alcoholics coming out of treatment each year relapse within 12 months, some the first day. The cost to the U.S. economy, including actual treatment, time lost from work, wrecked cars, imprisonment, etc., is about, get this one, $442 billion a year. So the reason we need a radical approach to recovery is that we need a change from accepted and traditional forms. While an 80% failure rate may be traditional, I believe it is unacceptable, and that's why I wrote the book Radical Recovery, 12 Recovery Myths, the Addiction Survivor's Guide to the 12 Steps. The problem that we face is much bigger than alcohol and drugs. They are just symptoms of the problem. And so long as we continue to treat the symptom, to fall. I read a story one time which illustrates this point. This man grew up in a small rural community, and he visited a very large city for the first time. When he returned, his friends asked him, what was it like? And this is how he responded. Such tall buildings, such small people. If you were asked to write a report on our society's achievements, you could state that, one, we have found cures for many diseases. Two, we have put men on the moon. Three, we have made great scientific discoveries. And four, we have made many, many significant technological advances. For example, email and texting give us instant communication. Microwave ovens have freed up hours of time spent on food preparation. We have high-tech cell phones. We can call anyone, anytime, anywhere. The internet gives us immediate access to information on any subject we want. Wall Street created billions of dollars to help people buy homes. But our progress has come with a price. The Wall Street warriors, driven by greed, created a mortgage crisis that sent millions of Americans into bankruptcy and left many of us with homes that were worth far less than what we originally paid for them. With the internet, sexual predators have now gained access to our children. While online gambling at porno sites, we can now feed our addiction appetites 24 hours a day. Combining texting and driving has proved to be a lethal combination. With microwave ovens, we eat more, but we communicate less. Obesity has become the number one cause of preventable death in the United States. I grew up in New York City in the 1950s, and I never saw people standing at intersections begging for money. Today, I seem to see that everywhere. So with all the advances that we have made, not too many great men and women have emerged. And those few that have demonstrated greatness through service to mankind seldom make the headlines. Many of our heroes have fallen. Tiger Woods, Bernie Madoff, Bill O'Reilly, Kevin Spacey, Matt Lauer, and scores of lawyers, senators, governors, congressmen, clergy, high school teachers, and community leaders who got caught with their hands in someone's pants or someone's pocket. The springboard for getting back to the core values that brought us joy, peace, self-esteem, healthy form of self-love almost always comes in the form of a crisis. We hit a mental, emotional, physical, or spiritual bottom. The Chinese use a combination of two characters for the word crisis. These two characters designate danger and opportunity. And this seems to be true of every crisis. For some of us, the crisis can be like a speed bump. For others, it's like hitting a brick wall. But either way, it's a turning point. Depending on how we make the turn, we can find danger, we can find opportunity, or we can find death. We need to remind ourselves as alcoholics and drug addicts about one, our purpose, two, our goal, and three, our solution. And that's why it's important to seek out 12-step and big book meetings and avoid BGT meetings, bad group therapy, where the focus is on problems instead of solutions. We have sponsors, friends, psychologists, and psychiatrists that are available to us to help with our personal problems. And I think it may be better for us to bring those problems to them instead of dominating the group, talking about our bad day. So exactly what is our real purpose as AA members? If somebody asks you that question, what would you tell them? According to our recovery literature, our real purpose is to fit ourselves to be of maximum service to God and the people about us. And what are the goals that we seek to accomplish as members of Alcoholics Anonymous and Narcotics Anonymous? Here's what the original members of AA tell us, the goals they said. One, remember, it was agreed at the beginning that we would go to any lengths for victory over alcohol. Two, we decided to go to any lengths to find a spiritual experience. And what was the solution that they found? And here's what they tell us. We work out our solution on the spiritual as well as the altruistic plane. The dictionary defines altruism as an unselfish concern for the welfare of others. So here's the solution they found. They tell us, almost none of us liked, one, the self-searching. That's steps 1, 2, and 3. The leveling of our pride. That's step 4. The confession of our shortcomings, which the process requires for its successful combination. And that's step 5. If the purpose, goals, and solution given to us by the original members of AA are not in agreement with your purpose, goals, and objectives, what should you do? Or some other options? And here's some of the wisdom that the original members of AA passed on to us. If you think you can do the job in some other way or prefer some other spiritual approach, then follow your own conscience. We have no monopoly on God. We merely have an approach that has worked with us. One of the options that is available to us is rational recovery. You can reach them at www.rational.org. And here's some of the information you'll find on their website. Where is the nearest meeting? There are no rational recovery groups anywhere. This should come as very good news to you, because you are already aware that recovery groups are not only boring and the group's belief system doesn't make much sense, but the people there amount to bad company. People with more and worse problems than yours. People you wouldn't want to invite home for dinner. Strangely, you may feel uncomfortable or even deprived to discover that rational recovery is about self-recovery and not a group project in which you receive the attention and support of others. Yes, in rational recovery, you are on your own. Your desire to hang out with other substance abusers after dark is viewed just as your parents might have seen it long ago when they warned you to stay away from bad company. Your desire to mingle with other addicted people, however, is part of being addicted. How about that? One of the greatest assets that we possess as human beings is our ability to adapt. If our homes are destroyed by tornadoes, fires, hurricanes, mudslides, we adapt to temporary surroundings. So what initially feels awkward and strange gradually becomes a permanent part of our daily routine. Over time, we stop comparing our old way of living with our new way of living, and a new reality emerges. And that's what happened to me. Personal alcohol and drug use increased. As I became more mentally impaired, the door to that old way of living began to close very slowly. I did not see it coming. As long as I could see any opening in that door, I was able to con myself into believing that I did not have a problem. But the day eventually arrived when the millions of brain cells I killed finally took their toll, and I began to feel like the popcorn machine Andrew Orr describes in his poem, Out of Order. In the poem, he describes a scene where a young mother is trying to explain to a 4-year-old boy that the popcorn machine is broken and it just is not capable of giving out its contents. I really believe that this aptly describes the crisis that we face as alcoholics and drug addicts. So here's Out of Order. Going, child, the machine is out of order. See, there's a sign on the machine. But he didn't understand. After all, he had the desire. He had the money. He could see the popcorn inside the machine. And yet, somehow, somewhere, something was wrong because he couldn't get the popcorn. So the boy walked back with his mother, and I could see that he wanted to cry. And Lord, I too felt like weeping. Weeping for people who have become locked in, jammed, and broken. filled with goodness that other people need and want and yet may never come to enjoy because something has gone wrong inside. How about that? Now, according to the U.S. Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services, 80% of alcoholics and drug addicts coming out of treatment centers relapse within the first 12 months. For some of us, it's the first day. And the cost to the U.S. economy, including actual treatment, time lost from work, wrecked cars, and all the other chaos and problems that come with addiction, you won't believe this, is $440 billion a year. So the reason we need a radical approach to recovery today is that we need a change from accepted and traditional forms. While an 80% failure rate is traditional in our fellowship, I believe that it is not acceptable. We are in a very unique position to help other alcoholics and drug addicts because we have lived and survived the nightmare of addiction. In addition to working with newcomers, it's so important that we have other goals. The number of meetings they will attend each week, reading recovery literature, working the steps, contact with the sponsor, service work. But before they attempt to identify their goals, perhaps it's important to make a distinction between wishes and goals. A wish is a desire without energy, things that we think about, but we don't really know if or when they'll happen. Goals, on the other hand, are things that we work for, specific things that we have decided we will accomplish by a specific date. And goals have power and act as barometers by which we can measure our success. And they're important because if we don't know where we are going, any road will get us there. And think about this. We can be fooled by our wishes, but we cannot be fooled by our goals. So what can we do to help ourselves and newcomers set worthy and realistic goals? Perhaps one of our first obligations is to provide newcomers with the vital and critical information they need to become addiction survivors. Much of what they need to learn can be found in the books Alcoholics Anonymous and Narcotics Anonymous. But moving away from accepted and traditional forms, we may also want to refer them to other recovery literature that will help them get anchored in their recovery. For example, when Bill Wilson wrote the book Alcoholics Anonymous, he had 3 years of sobriety behind him. When he wrote the book 12 Steps and 12 Traditions, he had 17 years of sobriety behind him. When he wrote As Bill Sees It, which was originally titled The AA Way of Life, he had 32 years of sobriety behind him. Some of us never go beyond the big book. I've been at many meetings where people have said, that's the only book you need to read. And in doing so, we discount all the knowledge, wisdom, and experience that Bill and our fellowship gained over those 32 years of sobriety. So, are these three books part of your library? When was the last time you read them? Let's go back to 1930. And imagine being in your doctor's office and the nurse takes out your file and puts it on her desk. Underneath your name is stamped the word terminal, as in uniqueness, as in hopeless. And a psychiatrist, that's how they viewed alcoholics as well as drug addicts in the 1930s. For the medical profession, alcoholism and drug addiction were dead ends. Your doctor and psychiatrist told you that there was nothing they could do to help you. So where could you turn to for help in 1930? Nowhere. Then one day in 1934, a bright light appeared at the end of a very large, dark tunnel called addiction. Abby Thatcher, who had been sober for 2 months, knocked on the door of his old drinking buddy, Bill Wilson. And this is the day that hope was born for us alcoholics and drug addicts. Here's what Bill saw when he answered the knock on the door. The door opened, and he stood there, fair-skinned and glowing. There was something different about his eyes. He was inexplicably different. What had happened? I pushed a drink across the table. He refused it. Disappointed but curious, I wondered what had got into this fellow. He wasn't himself. "Come, what's this all about?" I queried. He looked me straight in the eye. Simply but smilingly, he said, "I've got religion." I was aghast. So that was it. Last summer, an alcoholic crackpot. Now, did a little cracked about religion. He had that starry-eyed look. Yes, the old boy was on fire, all right. But bless his heart, let him rant. Besides, my gin would last longer than his preaching. But he did know ranting. In a matter-of-fact way, he told me how two men had appeared in court, persuading the judge to suspend his commitment. They had told of a simple religious idea and a practical program of action. That was 2 months ago, and the result was self-evident. It worked. He had come to pass his experience on to me, if I cared to have it. I was shocked, but interested. Certainly I was interested. I had to be, for I was hopeless. Out of this hopelessness, AA was born, along with a very radical approach to recovery. While Bill liked what he saw, the miracle standing in front of him, he had a problem. The radical solution offered by his friend Evie, God, was perhaps a little too radical for him. So he says, "Despite the living example of my friend, there remained in me traces of my old prejudice." That word, God, still aroused a certain aversion. When the thought was expressed to me that there might be a personal God, that feeling just intensified. I did not like the idea. I could go for such conceptions as creative intelligence, the universal mind, spirit of nature, but I resisted the thought of a czar of the heavens, however loving his sway might be. I have since talked with scores of men who felt the same way. I had always believed in a power greater than myself. I had often pondered these things. I was not an atheist. Few people really are. But that means blind faith, faith in the strange proposition that this universe originated from nothing and aimlessly rushes nowhere. My intellectual heroes, chemists, astronomers, even the evolutionists, suggested vast laws and forces at work. Despite contrary indications, I had little doubt that a mighty purpose and rhythm underlay all. How could there be so much precise and immutable law and no intelligence? I simply had to believe in the spirit of the universe who knew neither time nor limitation. But when they talked of a personal God who was love, superhuman strength, and direction, I became irritated. My mind snapped shut against such a theory. So what was the radical solution that Abby Thatcher offered to Bill Wilson? He tells us, "My friend sat before me, and he made the point-blank declaration that God had done for him what he could not do for himself. His human will had failed him. Doctors had pronounced him incurable, as in terminal. Society was about to lock him up. Myself, he had admitted complete defeat. Then he had, in effect, been raised from the dead, suddenly taken from the scrap heap to a level of life better than the best he had ever known. Had this power originated in him? Obviously, it had not. There had been no more power in him than there was in me at that minute, and that was none at all, and that floored me. It began to look as though the religious people were right after all. Here was something at work in a human heart which had done the impossible. My ideas about miracles were drastically revised right then. Never mind the musty past. Here sat a miracle directly across the kitchen table, and he shouted great tidings. I saw that my friend was much more than inwardly reorganized. He was on a different footing. His roots grasped a new soil." So what was Bill's attitude toward religion? He tells us, "To Christ I conceded the certainty of a great man, followed by those who claimed him. His moral teaching, most excellent. For myself, I had adopted those parts which seemed convenient and not too difficult. The rest, I disregarded. The wars which had been fought over the centuries, the burnings, bombings, and deceptions that religious disputes had facilitated, made me sick. I honestly doubted whether, on balance, the religions of mankind had done any good. Judging from what I had seen and worked, was negligible. The brotherhood of man, a grim jest. If there was a devil, he seemed to be the boss universal, and he certainly found me." So, how did Bill find a solution to his dilemma? Here's what he tells us. "My friend suggested what then seemed a novel idea. He said, 'Why don't you try and choose your own conception of God?'"